This is Telling Tales with Ms. G, and I have a couple of, well, actually three short stories for you tonight. So I'll give you a chance to get settled, and I'll be right back here at 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. This is Ms. G, and I'm back with tonight's story. The first story is titled The Invasion by Alvin Smith. President Komoda fell into a trance, and in that trance he saw foreigners coming to invade his country. When he came out of the trance, he ordered that all the national treasures be taken to the sacred mountain of the ancestors, where they could be safely hidden from the invaders. A month later, General Madlark, with two other officers, walked arrogantly into President Komoda's office. He had the attitude of a conqueror prepared to take power. His invading army met no resistance because the founders of the country of Komoka had it written in their constitution that the country will not have a standing army. As the general entered the office, the first thing he looked for, and it wasn't there, was the headdress worn by the legitimate ruler of the country. He observed that the office was quite large, with holographic images of past presidents placed around it. Two large flags of the country stood on either side of a large desk, on which sat a computer and writing materials. There were also two chairs and a couple of sofas. President Komoda was sitting at his desk, working on the computer. He was a man about 60 with white hair and no facial hair. He looked up and saw a man about 5 feet 10 inches tall, black hair, clean-shaven, in a camouflage military uniform. He said in a calm voice, "General, I've been expecting you." The general thought, how can he be expecting me when the operation was planned and carried out with utmost secrecy? He spoke aloud. "Since you have been expecting me, let me dispense with formalities and get to the point. My government sent me to take control of your country. The problem is that you have a large deposit of Terratanium in Mount Sandar, and you refuse to let us have it. So we are going to take it. Do you know what you are doing is violation of international law?" "Yes, we do. But since you are a defenseless nation, we can take your country without a problem. All you have to do is sign these documents and tell me where the national treasures are hidden." Komoda laughed loudly and said, "You must be joking." "No joke," said the general. "I have no information to give," said Komoda. "Without the national treasures, the people will know that our replacements are not legitimate, that the country will be ungovernable. It is a serious miscalculation on your part if you think we are going to give you our country without resistance." "What resistance can you offer? We are the most technologically advanced army in the world." "And you don't even have an army." "You don't know it yet, General, but you will soon find out. We know how to use the force of nonviolent resistance, pioneered by Gandhi and later used by Martin Luther King." "We don't expect you to give up the country for nothing. We will arrange to give you and your ministers large sums of money and exile in Europe." "No, General, we cannot be bought," replied the president. "If you don't agree to our demands right now, we have ways of persuading you," said the general. Seeing that he was getting nowhere, he said to his officers, "Restrain him." "No need to get rough, General. I'll do what you want," the president calmly said. General Madlock opened his attaché case and from it took a small gadget, which had a screen, pulled out three electrodes, walked over to the president, and attached them to his head. He turned one dial, and nothing happened. He turned another dial. Still, nothing happened. A frown appeared on the general's face. "It seems that this brain graph is defective," he said. "Remove your hat, Major Dunkley, so I can check it." Major Dunkley promptly removed his hat. The general attached the brain graph to the major's head, turned a dial, and on the screen appeared images and words of everything stored in the major's memory for that day. He scanned the major's memory backwards for a couple of years, satisfied that the function was working. He turned the pain dial to 2. The major's face contorted in pain. The general turned and attached the instrument to the president's head. He turned the memory recall dial to the max. Again, nothing happened. He turned the pain dial to the max. The president showed no reaction. The calm demeanor of the president was beginning to irritate him. He said, "I don't know why this stupid thing instrument doesn't work on you, but we are the greatest power on earth, so we'll get this thing figured out, and sooner or later, you will have to take orders from us." With that, he walked out of the president's office. His officers followed. Back at headquarters, the general threw his briefcase on his desk, then went directly to his liquor cabinet, got himself a glass, and screwed the top of a bottle half full of whiskey, poured a couple ounces, and drank it in one gulp. For the rest of the day, he received briefings from his officers that he sent out to interrogate the leadership of government, civil servants, and people at random. The results were all the same. The emotion analysis showed that these people were not motivated by greed and showed no fear of them. The general scratched his head and thought, "How are we going to rule if we can't rule by fear?" That thought occupied his mind for the rest of the day and most of the night. The last time he looked at his watch, it was 0300 hours. In his first dream, he dreamt that he was in officer's lounge drinking with his colleagues, and they are making fun of him, saying that he cannot defeat even defenseless people. In his second dream, he dreamt that a mighty python crawled into his bed, wrapped itself around him, squeezing the life out of him. He woke up suddenly in a cold sweat. It was about 0600 hours when he called his superior. "General Marsaf, sir, I called to give you a briefing of what is happening here. Things are not going according to plan. First, the invasion was not a surprise. They were expecting us. So they emptied their museums of all their nation's treasures. Now the population knows that there is an invasion. You're not going to believe this, sir, but we did brain analysis of the top leadership and we cannot access their memory, neither can we activate their pain center. We also did a random sampling of the population, and they don't show fear. The problem I've been thinking about, sir, is that since these people aren't motivated by greed or fear, how are we going to rule?" "That's a good question, General. Tell you what, I'll consult with the politicians and get back to you." "Okay, bye." You just heard me read The Invasion by Alvin Smith. Imagine, can't rule by fear. This is Ms. G bringing you Telling Tales here at 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska, and I'll be right back with another story. Stay tuned. Thank you. again. This is Ms. G with Telling Tales here at 104.3. And I have another story for you. Another short one. It's called Knock Knock by Jonathan Lowe. Well, let me see if I got this straight, said Russell Anderson, 60 Minutes, co-producer and bureau chief for CBS News. You're saying that Thomas Sedan, a rancher from Naco, Arizona, captured the head of the Cali cartel on his property the day before yesterday and has offered him to the Border Patrol in exchange for what again? There was a momentary silence at the other end of the line, which was ghosted by background noise. Then the White House press secretary replied evenly, "Anything he wants, and I mean anything, including what he did choose, which, while I agree, is highly unusual. The president wants a victory in the drug war to sidestep other problems, and we believe Raul Garzapata is the key." Go over that part again, will you? The part I'm not understanding. I understand about Garzapata, his full disclosure on Sedan's interrogation transcript, the record of kickbacks, and the reparations promised to avoid the death penalty. That's obvious. And may I speak frankly, boring. Tell me exactly what the president promised him again. The press secretary sighed. I thought I made that clear. Didn't you hear me, Mr. Anderson? Maybe you should wait for the press conference in 1 hour and ask that question again. Anderson coughed. I'm sorry, sir. I didn't mean to imply that Garzapata is not important. But you know what it is people will be asking about, surely. So I have to ask you several things, just to be clear. One more moment, please, just to verify. The press secretary sighed again. Very well. As I said, a deal was struck with Sedan, whose ranch in Arizona is some 5,000 acres, straddling the border. That's right. On both sides. And the president has agreed to the terms of this agreement by signing an executive order into law. That is correct. When? 2 hours ago in the Oval Office, in exchange for Mr. Sedan's cooperation in acting as agent for the U.S. government, he has been granted carte blanche for 1 year, effective immediately. And that means? It means that as of today, Mr. Thomas Sedan has the legal right to enter any private home in America at any time he chooses. He cannot remove anything, nor can he take photographs. He may only enter and observe at his leisure. No U.S. citizen may refuse him entry under penalty of law. He is free to come and go as he wishes for the duration of 1 year. And this is specifically what he requested. Yes, not $1 million. A new red Porsche or an ambassadorship to Mexico. Yes, Mr. Anderson, he didn't want my job either, thank goodness. Also, it was offered to him. But why? I mean, what's his motive? What's he hope to gain by? There has been some speculation on that point here. Perhaps the power or the novelty of it is attractive to him. Or maybe he's a voyeur. Please don't use that word, Mr. Anderson. Why not? Haven't you walked down your own street at night and looked at the windows of your neighbor's homes? Imagine being able to legally enter any home you want at any time, and the owner of that home can't bar your entry. What I want to know is how. What about rights to privacy? How can the president do this, even this president? Privacy rights are waived solely on behalf of Mr. Sedan, and only for 1 year. He is exempt and immune from any violation. And Congress has been unable to prevent it, as they are deadlocked in other matters as well. So for the duration of Executive Order 1482-421, no homeowner may prevent Mr. Sedan from coming into their home and observing or searching. Searching? Anderson stood and circled his desk in awe. Oh, now I get it. He's going to be cooperating with you guys, isn't he? If he finds drugs or evidence of murder, they'll be admissible in court because he has the sole right to enter without a warrant. That's it, isn't it? The voice on the line tried to evoke calm. I have no comment on that point, Mr. Anderson, except to say that Mr. Sedan will have the full cooperation of the law enforcement, including an escort if he desires. Police must remain outside, however. They do not possess his rights. Whether Mr. Sedan chooses to reveal what he finds is entirely up to him. Anderson cleared his throat and steadied himself with his free hand on the chair. Oh, my God. Peeping Tom does want money. millions. Guilty people will pay him a fortune not to tell. He'll be as rich as Midas, won't he? Where'd he go first, Beverly Hills? Again, that's up to him. Up to him, the 60 Minutes producer repeated in a daze. Holy hopscotch. This guy is smart. Fame and fortune at the stroke of a pen. What's he going to wear, though? Kevlar? He will be protected by both police and by the fame he achieves via executive order. Oh, my God. And if this is true, that's who he is, right? He's got. For 1 year, that is correct. If anyone refuses entry, they will be committing a sin. No, a felony. What's the difference? With a sin, you pay later. With a felony, you pay now, Mr. Anderson. 10 to 20 years in federal prison, based on the severity of the offense. Severity of the offense? Anderson laughed, albeit nervously. Yet the smile on his face felt too good to be true. Who decides the severity of the offense? No, don't tell me. He does. So you see how it works. Yes, I do. But what if someone pretends not to be home? Well, they'll still come in to your room, even if you're not home. And that would make Mr. Sedan very angry, would it not, by pretending. Ineffective as well, because he also has the right to force entry when he suspects he is being denied. How? With a SWAT team battering ram, should he request it? Holy, listen, Mr. Anderson, I really have to go now. I've given you too much time already. Certainly, sir, I understand. Thanks. Thanks so much. This is the story we've been waiting for over 20 years. Anderson glanced at his watch. Tell me, does anyone outside the press know about this yet? No, Mr. Anderson, and goodbye. Thank you, sir. Thank you, and thank the president. Anderson hung up and then punched his intercom. Julie, get me Steve Clough on the phone now. Yes, sir, his secretary's voice chimed. What about the man who's been... Never mind, Julie. Listen to me. This is important. Cancel everything else today. No calls, no appointments, and I want the senior staff in my office in 10 minutes. Katie Kirk included. Got that? But, sir, do it, Julie. Yes, sir. Anderson sat and leaned back into his leather armchair. He imagined hiring Sedan to replace a retiring Andy Rooney, a one-year exclusive contract with bonuses based on ratings. He linked his fingers behind his head and now briefly smiled at the prospect of a whole new and unlimited source of privileged information. Then he thought about what skeletons he had in his own closet, an obvious consideration in hiring such a man-god. What if Sedan became displeased with his perks over time or wanted to extend his contract? What documents would need shredding in that case? Oh, my God. He remembered his complicity 2 years prior in a CIA cover-up. What when some idiot in the Bush administration proposed bombing Mecca, leaving clues that unknown radical religious terrorists did it? Of course, Operation Buddha Bomb had never gotten off the drawing board, and the CIA operative who leaked the memos had since disappeared. But what if Sedan didn't care about Britney or Madonna or some mafia don with a beach house and a payroll of cleaning agents? What if he wanted to go after the establishment itself? Would his copy of the CIA non-disclosure agreement protect him, just as it secured certain intelligence favors and maintained 60 Minutes' very mystique? Several reporters had been killed to keep the operation secret, too. Anderson finally shrugged off his fear when the CBS regulars gathered in his office, and then he felt a giddy sense of the power hiring such a man would mean, knowing that, at long last, no one would be able to escape public scrutiny, not even Democratic presidential hopefuls. He waited until it was standing room only to speak. Gentlemen, he announced, and Katie. The phone rang, interrupting him. He snatched it up. What? Mr. Anderson, his secretary said. I've got Steve Croft on line two, but I think you should know. Know what? Well, remember you told me to cancel all appointments? Yes. This is odd, sir, but, well, I sent the man without an appointment away first, but he got pretty angry. He'd been waiting about 20 minutes, remember? Anyway, he just called me back, and I think you should know he's at your house now. Who did you say? Who's there? I'm not sure, but here's the odd part. Caller ID shows it to be your home number. You just heard me read Knock Knock by Jonathan Lowe. I hope you enjoy this story. Well, careful what you wish for. Okay, this is Ms. G, and I am bringing you Left Hanging here at 104.3. I'll be right back with my last story of the evening. Stay tuned. With Telling Tales here at 104.3. And my last story of the evening is titled The New Religion by Claire Redaway. It all began the day that Martin Jenkins decided to start a new religion. Martin lived at number 42 Richmond Crescent in Bath. He was 53, balding, and his chronic astigmatism meant that the lens in his glasses were getting really thick. He was deputy head of sales at a phone subsidiary in an out-of-town shopping precinct. "I'll be a director any time now," he boasted to his wife before she ran off with the news agent to grow strawberries in Kent. He was an odd choice for a messiah. He longed to work at the company's main branch in the High Street, for a desk with his name on it and for his team to call him Sir. It was never going to happen. One drizzly Thursday in mid-May, he heard that yet again a younger man with lustrous curls and contact lenses had been promoted above him. "That's it," he said. Martin was not a religious man. He'd fallen out with the local vicar when she'd refused to guarantee his wife's eternal damnation. However, Martin had always had a kind of spiritual itch. This combined with his frustration and his ardent belief in the adage, "If you want something done well, do it yourself," made what happened next almost inevitable. One evening he was surfing the net. As he ran a search for some new wellies, an advertisement popped up. Cut Price Investments. He'd never seen an ad for investments before, and he laughed at first. Then he looked thoughtful. Then he started to scribble. Some weeks later, the householders in the Crescent received a flyer through their letterbox. It read, "Living in a religious vacuum, searching for moral inspiration, angry with the council's spending on recycling. Join Brother Martin this Friday at 8 o'clock. All welcome." Martin rather regretted putting in the bit about recycling, but the council did annoy him. It really did. It was as if he'd personally caused global warming by letting the bin men take his daily mail. He'd wondered what to call himself. St. Martin? Lama Martin? After all, as founder of a breakaway religion, he could take the best bits from everyone else. Modestly, he'd opted for Brother. He could always change it later. He decided to start small. He'd hone his ideas on his core congregation, the local householders. Not all the householders, of course. He'd taken care not to leaflet Lucien Marksbury at number 38. Lucien, who always parked his sports car in what Martin thought of as his parking space. Lucien, whose son Max was so pale, so thin, and so frequently clad in black that he must either be on heroin or plotting a Columbine-style school massacre. Lucien, who never bothered to say hello, he was definitely not invited. That Friday, Martin came home from work early. He put the miniature cheesecloths and spicy spring rolls that he'd bought from Waitrose into the oven and set out the glasses on the coffee table in the front room. Then he changed. He'd ironed his new cassock the night before. He pulled it over his shirt and trousers. Wearing a long white dress gave him an unusual feeling. Lovingly, he lifted the red silk chasuble from its tissue-lined box. He slipped it over his head. It fell to the middle of his thighs, the short sleeves brushing his elbows. It was heavy, rich with gold embroidery. He straightened his backbone and pulled back his shoulders. He looked in the mirror. A stranger was standing there, a stranger with an air of authority and wisdom. But the stranger had no hat. Martin frowned. He should have bought the meter offered on the website. There was a ring at the doorbell, dot on 8 o'clock. Martin nearly tripped in his haste to get to the door. Realizing the problem, he lifted his skirts delicately between his fingers. He opened the door with his other hand. It was Jessie Hicks, number 2, upstairs flat. Her hair was as wild and wispy as ever, and her eyes darted to left and right as she said, "I brought my viola. I thought, you know, a musical accompaniment. Do you mind? I can take it away, but I thought you might appreciate a little light music between the whatever. I've brought a selection." Martin held up his hand. "Thank you, Jessie." He thought briefly about Sister Jessie. "Music is soothing to the soul. Enter." Jessie scurried in. Martin wondered about his priestly voice. Could he carry it off? The doorbell rang again. It was Mrs. Frobisher, from number 15, a woman of a certain age. She was an active member of Neighborhood Watch, the Residents Association, the Local Conservation Association, the WI, and for all Martin knew, every other local and national association that would have her. "Evening, Martin," she said. "Thought I'd better come and make my presence felt. Always best to be in on the ground floor. This is the first meeting of your new religion, isn't it? Are we through here?" She swept past him into the front room where Jessie was on the floor retrieving the music she'd scattered. The bell rang again. Martin opened the door to Rajiv, who lived at number 28, and Jonathan and Emma, number 27. "Surprised to see you," he said to Rajiv. "Anything to get away from the wife," grinned Rajiv, his gold tooth glittering. "Like the dress." "They're my vestments," Martin explained, but Rajiv went straight through to where Jessie could be heard tuning up. Jonathan and Emma, a pleasant couple who had recently moved to the Crescent, smiled hesitantly. "We thought," said Jonathan. "We'd like to meet some of the," said Emma. "Other people in the street," finished Jonathan. "Welcome," said Martin solemnly. "Please, go on through." He was about to follow them when there was another ring at the bell. "I've touched a chord," thought Martin. "The residents are parched for a new way. I shall quench their thirst." He opened the door. It was Lucian. "Rajiv told me about your shindig. This I have to see. Like the get-up, dude," he said, and he was in. Grumpily, Martin followed him into the front room where he found everyone chattering happily and Rajiv polishing off the last of the cheese puffs. Martin held up his hand for silence. "Perhaps we can close our eyes and bow our heads for an opening prayer," he intoned, and they did. Martin felt a rush. This must be what the Pope feels, he thought, on that balcony over St. Peter's Square. After the prayer, Martin briefly outlined the bare bones of his religion. Obligatory services on a Friday, though obvious no murder, thieving, coveting, etc., no immoral behavior, by which Martin meant no adultery. The congregation looked sympathetic. No drugs, Jessie took a worried swig at her wine. No bare midriffs, Rajiv stared at the ceiling, Mrs. Rajiv's tummy rippled gloriously beneath her, sorry. No inconsiderate non-neighborly behavior. Lucian raised his eyebrows and a refusal to recycle. To Martin's surprise, they all seemed keen. Also, Lucian said that he wanted to point out again that it was unrestricted on-street parking in the Crescent. Then they started to add their own ideas. No music after 10 o'clock. No vomiting in the street when drunk. Compulsory weeding of front gardens. How about, instead of fish, mandatory curry on Friday? This was Rajiv, whose brother-in-law owned the nearest takeaway. No dog fouling, punishable by... What's it punishable by, Martin? Asked Miss Frobisher. Hellfire, Martin improvised, out of his depth by the religious snowballing. Democracy had not been his plan. Marvelous. Dog fouling, punishable by hellfire. Are we minuting this? Shall I do the honors? A couple of hours later, they'd drawn up a constitution, a motley collection of regulations for the new religion. Martin was sad there hadn't been time for a proper service as he'd written a blistering sermon on the dangers of recycling. However, they agreed to reconvene next week, and in the meantime to put together a uniform for their missionary work in the town center on a Saturday night. Their aim was to restore clean, quiet, and pleasant streets to residents, using some minimal violence if necessary. Emma had promised to fashion an emblem for them from the feathers of birds killed by her cat, Pickles. As they drifted away, it was felt that an interesting evening had been had by all. As the weeks went by, the congregation swelled. Once there were 15 people in Martin's front room. Martin was pleased, particularly as Lucian never came again. A pattern was established, a service with sermon led by Brother Martin, followed by a barbecue on the terrace, weather permitting. Jessie provided music, now accompanied by a banjo, number 9, and a piccolo, number 17. The first pair to patrol the streets comprised Martin in mufti, but sporting a magpie feather badge, and Jessie, sustained by a couple of double vodkas. The patrol was not a triumph. They found that most revelers left the pubs and bars in an annoyingly orderly fashion. Some hours passed before they found a fracas in a back alley. Jesse's polite tap on the shoulder had no effect on the two lads involved, so Martin stepped between them. The policeman who arrived shortly afterwards on his bicycle had little sympathy for Martin's black eye, muttering about vigilantes making his job harder. In light of this, Martin suggested that his congregation withdrew temporarily from missionary work. "Let us retrench and focus on the community around us," he said at the end of his sermon, which that week tackled the topic of helping the neighbor by watching him closely. "Let's take the plank out of our own eye," agreed Miss Frobisher. "I'll lead a patrol tomorrow, first thing. Report back next Friday." Friday brought bad news. Most of the Crescent were cooperative, readily agreeing to weeding, fouling, and parking suggestions. However, Martin was not surprised to hear that Lucien had been recalcitrant. He'd even sworn at the missionaries. Martin stiffened his back and straightened his new meter. "Will we accept this?" he asked. "No," the congregation shouted. "Bring him to me," Martin said. Rogier started to laugh, but was met by silence. Mrs. Frobisher stepped forward. "I'll go," she said. She was joined by Jesse, Jonathan, and Alfred from next door, who had initially come around to ask for a sponsorship for a school bike ride, but had been seduced by the cheese puffs. Mrs. Frobisher led her team into the Crescent. The rest of the congregation waited, gathered around the sausages on the barbecue. Only Rajiv melted away. 10 minutes later, Lucien was dragged onto the terrace. His hair was disheveled and his face was red. Martin was thrilled. The mighty Lucien, the sneering Lucien, the devil-may-care Lucien, brought to Martin's terrace by Martin's command to do Martin's bidding. Imagining a flaming sword, he raised the nearest thing to hand. "Don't you wave those bloody barbecue tongs at me, you weirdo," shrieked Lucien. "And get your monkeys off me." "Do you, Lucien Marksbury, agree to abide by the rules of the Richmond Religious Order?" intoned Martin. "No, of course I don't. What are you going to do, make me?" jeered Lucien. Martin turned. He lifted a red-hot coal from the barbecue and held it in the tongs. His congregation gasped. He took a step towards Lucien. "Are you sure?" he said. Lucien took a step back, but he was held too tightly to move far. "An arm, Brother Martin?" inquired Mrs. Frobisher, and she started to unbutton Lucien's cuff. As Martin took another step towards Lucien, there was a scuffle at the edge of the terrace. A camera flashed. Startled, Martin turned. "I've called the police," said Max, pointing the camera at Martin. "They'll be here any minute. One more step towards my dad and it's assault with a deadly weapon." The camera flashed again. Martin blinked his way back to his senses. "Let him go," he said to Mrs. Frobisher. She'd already dropped Lucien's arm. "Don't think you've heard the last of this," said Lucien as he turned and stumbled out of the house. When the police arrived, there was no incident to quell. Lucien decided not to press charges. The Chronicle, however, published a quarter-page color photograph of a Bath resident in the dress of a full bishop brandishing a burning hot coal. "Love thy neighbor, Ichabod," before warning readers that barbecue coals can be hot. Martin's congregation dwindled after that. Most of the residents felt a little sheepish. Even Mrs. Frobisher was seen to apologize to Lucien. Martin was philosophical. Perhaps some of his popularity was due to the entertainment options available in Bath on a Friday night. He joined the local Amdram Society and is due to play the vicar in their next production. If he is asked, Martin always says that he's learned his lesson. But sometimes he thinks back and he smiles as he remembers that there was just a moment when Lucien Marksbury, popular, successful Lucien Marksbury, had looked at him and had been really very scared. This has been Telling Tales with Ms. G. It has been great being back and reading to you tonight. Until next time, good night and have a nice turkey day.